Hello and welcome along to the RTE Rugby Podcast. Another busy week with plenty to sink our teeth into here. Two big derby games and wins for Leinster and Ulster. More than enough talking points as well as some wider issues around the game as well. Later, Hannah O'Connor will be joining me to look back at Ireland's brilliant WXV campaign. A second win out of three games for Scott Beaman's side on Friday night. 26-14 winners against the USA, which sees them finish second place overall and cap off a brilliant 2024. For now, Bernard Jackman and Johnny Holland are with me. Morning, fellas. How are we doing?
Good. Very good, thanks.
We had two very, 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 very big games last weekend. But I think before we actually get into talking about the matches and looking ahead to this weekend, Michael, throw a couple of talking points from the week, shake things up a little bit, because something that's been a big talking point in the last 48 hours has been 20-minute red cards, which are on the table to be pushed forward for an expanded trial when World Rugby's council meet later next month. On Monday, though, the French Rugby Union came out with a stinging rebuke against them. I'll just read out some quotes here against it. So the French Rugby Federation, the National Rugby League and the Players' Union, Proval, all issued a joint statement on Monday, which made it clear they would firmly oppose the move, which was trialled out in the Rugby Championship and the World Rugby Under 20 Championship over the summer, and which we saw in 2021 in the Rainbow Cup here. So they said the red card is an essential tool to deter dangerous behaviour on the field and guarantee safety of our players. Reducing this sanction to a temporary exclusion of 20 minutes would weaken our ability to protect the physical integrity of athletes and to maintain fair play, fundamental values of rugby. We call on World Rugby to reconsider this experiment, ensuring that any decision is based on concrete and convincing data, which is not the case today. As they point out, the data available is quite small and the sample size of the trial has been quite small. Interested to get your own takes on it. I might start with yourself, Bernard.
Yeah, I agree with the French take. I'm not in favour of this at all. I think that it's not aligned to what World Rugby are saying around player safety. You know, we've seen over the last 4 or 5 years a big focus on head contact, illegal tackles, etc. And now with this, they're saying, you know, a 20-minute red card, I just think sends the wrong message to players. And it's coming from the Southern Hemisphere, where they're desperate to try and revitalize the game. You know, obviously, you know, the big test matches are still selling out, but below that, there's a big issue in terms of getting spectators through, TV figures, etc. So they're desperate, and I think there's other ways. I think the game is still a great game, and we've got to keep the red card at full, I suppose, punishment, in that you go off, whether it's in the first minute or the last minute, you're gone from the field, and you face the consequences after that. So for me, personally, I think it's totally the wrong move, and I'm really shocked and surprised that World Rugby are going down this road.
That's what Bernard just said at the end there, kind of shocked and surprised that World Rugby are going down this route, Johnny, is the way I was kind of thinking of it as well, because I know I was chatting to you the other day, and something I said was that, like, for me, it has felt like in the last 12 months or so, it feels like teams and coaches and even a lot of spectators actually had started coming around to the fact that a red card meant a red card. I thought I was seeing a lot less complaining from supporters that, oh, here's another red card, that's a game ruined, which is something that kind of happened every time a red card was given out a few years ago. My own personal opinion was I thought I was seeing that way less so that's kind of why I'm a little bit surprised to see it being pushed through so hard.
Yeah, the timing is shocking, isn't it? Because I'm with you. I think, from my experience, and it might be a small subset as well, but like from my experience, players, coaches and those within the actual game itself haven't been the ones complaining about it. I know there might be a certain incident where they're going, geez, that's harsh. But I think that's the outlier. And I think the people within the confines of the pitch, at least, or surrounding area, were never really complaining that much. Because I think we know when you're in the middle of the game or very close to it, I think you know how dangerous head contact is. And we're talking about head contact a lot because I think that's where this has probably stemmed from, you know, accidental being upright and not meaning it. And so I think the people close to it know, like if anyone has a concussion or has had a concussion or has experienced a kind of a a tough collision that you've seen people come off worse for wear. I think you've bought into red cards and the tackle height and all that kind of stuff, and not really having any way out of that. Like, I think it's a red card for me, and you should go off the pitch. I don't really, it doesn't bother me if it's an error, if it's an accidental error, because you're upright. You know, if you want to not get red cards, don't be upright. I think, like, the Josh Murphy one at the weekend, we can get into that later on, but you know, it's kind of more glancing. I know he doesn't really mean to put a shot on a fella, but he's upright, like, and that's what we're trying to get rid of. It's behavior change, and you're not going to change behavior if you lessen the sanction. So I'm very against it. I think there was, if you look at, like, social media and X in particular, you'll get a lot of mad opinions on the red card. I don't think that's really altogether accurate the closer you get to the game. I think people closer to the game are against the 20-minute red card. So I'm also shocked, and I wholeheartedly disagree with it. I think, like, you know, you go back along, people would say red cards are only for the worst foul play you'll ever see. Like, and I don't think the game can tolerate that anymore. And if you look at other sports, like if you look at soccer and you go studs up or over the ball, it could be accidental or your timing could be off and you might not mean to hurt the guy, but it's a red card. You know, so, like, let's not bother giving people the out or the excuse, it's a red card, get off the pitch, like, and change your behavior.
And to see the prospect of a 20-minute red card plus substitution then coming through at the top level of the game, Johnny, like it's so different to what's happening just below the very, very top level of the game. Like yourselves in Cork On and all the clubs around the country, for more than a year now have been dealing with a reduced tackle height. And I'd be curious to see, like, how have you found that over getting used to that over the last year or so? How has that been enforced? Has that changed your behaviors around tackle? And obviously, now that it's actually just popped into my head, obviously, you know, you got a red card in the first half of the All-Ireland League final. That certainly didn't ruin the game, did it?
No, it didn't ruin the game. We've spoken about it before, but, like, you know, the player in question, I don't want to keep naming him because I need him to move on. But, like, he was very low and he just got his rap wrong. It was technically, I think, you know, I won't argue because we accepted it at the time and I still accept it. But we did accept it and the game, you know, took a life of its own because of that. And I think there's plenty of examples of that as well. But, you know, I don't see what they're trying to do if. There's a massive buy-in. I think if anything, people are calling for more sanction on high tackles in AIL level. And maybe it's just a little bit of it. You can get a penalty if you call for a high shot. But you hear, if you go to any AIL game, there's people calling for high shots left, right, and centre, and they
Do
want the
you,
penalties.
sorry to interrupt, do you as a coach and do you as a team feel comfortable now dealing with what that tackle height is and where you need to be? Like
Absolutely.
have your behaviors changed, do you think, in the last year?
They have. I don't think they're going to be always changed. Like, we'll be in training, and you know, Brian Scott will always be like, "That's a yellow card, or that's a red card." Like, you need to change your behavior. And players do find it tough, like, because the game is dynamic, and that's the part I understand. The game is very dynamic, and you know, the one we found at the start of the tackle height changing in the AIL was, you know, a winger or a fullback racing to cover the space, and next thing, someone steps in at high pace, and they're upright and they get caught. And it seemed very harsh. So that's the one we kept going back with. Like, what's he supposed to do in that instance? But I suppose it's slow your feet getting to him, show him the outside and tackle him low into touch. You know, there's an answer. It's difficult for players though. But in training, we often say to our players, like, that's a card of some colour. Like, you know, you need to change your height. And I hope the players will back me up on that because we do that a lot in training. So I think the behaviour has changed. Now there's no TMO in the AIL. I've definitely seen some tackles by our own players where I go, geez, we were lucky there. But it's hard for the referees because things are moving quite quickly. But if you had a TMO, you'd probably get, like Irwin in the final. I think that's only a red card because it was a TMO. It wouldn't have been a red. That happens every week in the AIL. So it's very hard to police it. But I think the behaviour and the acceptance around that tackle height, there's been massive buy-in. And I think we've done that for the greater good of the game. I think people know why we're doing it and it's been done for the greater good. So for the professional game to roll back on that, I think is quite disappointing for us as well.
Bernard, the IRFU say they're excuse me, still considering their position on this 20-minute red card plus a substitution. Would you like to see them follow the line of the French, who, in fairness, now who have given an opportunity to other unions to back them? You know, they don't have to be the ones stepping out.
Yeah, look, the French have been very strong around their resistance to it. I would like to see the IRFU follow them. Just the counter argument, just a quote from the New Zealand CEO, Mark Robinson, And he said, "We're the only sport in the world that creates a mismatch like we do and still expects fans to turn up and pay for it." I don't agree with that, that we're the only sport. I think it'll be good to see the red card come down in terms of the amount of minutes players spend off the field. We've got to keep driving hard at keeping the fan at the very forefront of what we're doing. And again, like I think the fans are absolutely massively important, but it's a collective here, and the players. And also, I don't agree that once a red card happens, the game is a done deal or it's boring. And he starts talking about less interventions from TMOs, which I think is a different issue altogether. I mean, like realistically, how many interventions do we have because of red cards? Hardly any. There are like most of the ones that are that TMO comes in on end up being a yellow rather than a red. You know what I mean? So, and I think that's going to go to TMO anyway, probably. So, yeah, I just don't. I know what's driving it, and it's this whole idea around how we can keep fans engaged. But I think this is a red herring, really. It's not the problem. So it's not why the game is dying on its feet in Australia and New Zealand.
I think that's exactly what I was going to follow up with. If this does get passed in 2 years' time, do you realistically see 50% more bums on seats in stadiums for Super Rugby matches in New Zealand?
No chance.
Right. We'll put a pin in that one, and we might come back to it again in a few more weeks when if there's any developments on it before that World Rugby Council meeting in November. We'll also talk Ireland internationals now, because we're only 3 weeks and 2 days out from the first of those games against New Zealand at the start of November at the Aviva Stadium. And what's going to be really interesting over the next couple of weeks is that there is a big audition probably to be had for who wants a starting hooker jersey and even the number 16 jersey probably for the game against New Zealand. So at the moment, Dan Sheehan is out until the new year. Ulster pretty much said yesterday Tom Stewart is going to be out till around Christmas. Ronan Kelleher had surgery, well, a minor surgery on an ankle issue last week, which was a 4 to 6 week recovery. Best case scenario, he could just about be back in time for New Zealand, but that would be an absolute best case scenario. Rob Herring is currently week to week on a calf problem and hasn't played this season. So, who is starting at hooker against New Zealand in 3 and a bit weeks' time, Bernard?
I'd say David Heffernan if Herring doesn't come back. If Herring comes back, he'd probably get the nod there. He probably wouldn't need to play a huge amount of games. One game would be enough.
Well, I think even just reading the update from Ulster yesterday, it
He
seems that
might.
he mightn't even be back for the last URC round
Okay. Well,
week.
that would obviously put Heffernan in pole position. I think Heffernan's form's been really good. I think Heffernan went down a little bit in the coach's estimation on that New Zealand tour, pre-World Cup, but I think he's bounced back really well. And I think they would have no problem with him starting. Obviously, he's not the same level of international experience or profile of a Dan Sheehan or Ronan Kelleher, but he's playing very well at the moment. I think it's going to be really interesting this week. If he gets the nod to start, which you would imagine he will for Connacht, my understanding is Gus McCarthy is going to start for Leinster. And I think Lee Barron picked up an ankle injury in the first half against Munster. So Gus McCarthy probably got more game time. He got a half, obviously having come back from South Africa. He is a very exciting player. And look, talking about him is probably disrespectful to Niall Scanlon and Dermot Barron, who I think, could go in there and do a job for sure. And maybe Farrell will go to one of those if needed, just because of the experience and the magnitude of an All Blacks match. But I think Gus McCarthy probably, he's the youngest hooker in the Leinster system. He's probably had a he's been fast tracked beyond expectation, I think. But he has the talent. He's a very exciting player. I like if he goes head to head with Heffernan at the weekend, or Dylan Tierney Martin. I'm fascinated to see how he goes, because I thought he did very well off the bench the weekend. I thought he was impressive earlier on in the season before he went away with Emerging Ireland. As someone I know, I've seen since he was 15, 16. And he's actually kind of doing what he did at schoolboy level now with senior pros, which at that age as a front five player isn't easy. So he's a bolter for sure. Barron was very good at first half as well. I'm not sure how bad his ankle is. But yeah, I would say of the fit ones at the moment, Heffernan's in pole position.
But like even moving beyond the New Zealand game, then like Johnny, Ronan Keller probably will be back later on in the campaign. But you know, there's a game against Fiji in there where even if Dave Heffernan is the starting hooker against New Zealand, it's very likely we'll probably see someone like Gus McCarthy get a cap during November, and also throw, I'd say, Diarmaid Barron into the mix there as well, who has been in wider Ireland squads previously before the World Cup and was so unlucky, excuse me, on Saturday to have to go off so early with with that head injury in what would have been a big audition for him as well at Croke Park.
Yeah, I think Diarmaid Barron is the one who will be desperately trying to get fit. You know, I think his stock was quite high. Was it the end of last year, really? I think Dave Heffernan has been like back to what Birch is saying there. I think Dave Heffernan is the guy in pole position. He played over 200 times with Connacht. He's a lot of experience.
Yeah,
He,
204 now.
yeah. So like, I think he's quite dynamic as well. You know, he's good off the back of the maul. He's not Dan Sheehan, but he is dynamic enough. So I think he's the one in pole position, and it's great for him. But Diarmaid Barron is someone that, you know, before Gus McCarthy was being spoken about, Diarmaid Barron was thereabouts. And I think in the medium term, you'd hope that he can get fit, because I think it's an opportunity for him. But it's gonna be very interesting. Like, I think it's not the worst thing in the world, although it is for individual players, but it's not the worst thing in the world for Ireland to have to build some depth, because I don't think it's always our way in terms of really pushing people through, you know, and rightly so. I think I'm not having a go here. I think, you know, they give a couple of people a go at a time, and you keep a lot of cohesion, and you give that person the best possible chance as well, when they're going in with a very experienced squad. But I would think if everyone was fit and playing to their strengths, I would probably go Dave Heffernan and Diarmaid Barron, and then Gus McCarthy, just because you have to consider like athletic development, ability to back it up week to week. But again, he's gone to South Africa. That tour is there to develop players, you know. So maybe there is something bigger on the horizon for him, and he's the one just going to be pushed through. And they have a better idea than us, you know. So I think Dave Heffernan for now. Diarmaid Barron on experience, but you know, Gus McCarthy should play at some stage in autumn.
Yeah, and as you pointed out, like it's not the worst thing to happen in the world, from an Irish point of view. Like we're 3 years out from a Rugby World Cup, and how many other times over the course of these next 3 years are you going to be, are you going to have four test hookers who are injured all at the same time? Like it's, you know, you're not exactly talking like there isn't much depth there at Hooker Ireland at the moment of three and four very solid options to work with even before this injury crisis.
No, just on that, I think did Niall Scanlon kind of push back into the World Cup squad at one stage, and you were thinking that his Irish days were done, and all of a sudden he's just straight back in. And you know, a lot to be said for if Andy Farrell is thinking a bit of experience get us through one campaign, you know what I mean? I know Niall's been out of the Irish setup for a while, but you know, experience in big games can go a long way. It depends on what way they're thinking. If they're just looking to consolidate, I think Niall could be able to shout as well. But if they're looking to push on at the start of the World Cup cycle, like you said, then you know, Gus McCarthy's the man.
Yeah, it was the tour in New Zealand 2022 when Scandal got in and played against the Maori. Apologise, I keep coughing. Throat's a little dry. Let's move on to the games then at the weekend. And before we get into the breakdown of the matches themselves, Birch, we don't talk about refereeing a lot on this podcast. I'd say we talk about refereeing less than most rugby podcasts would. The fact that there were issues in both games at the weekend, I think it's worth bringing up because we're not necessarily singling out something. But would you say the officiating was up to a good enough standard on a whole across those two interpros on Saturday?
No, I don't think it was. I don't think it was, and it's caused a lot of debate. I'm in favor of not having Irish referees do these games, to be fair. I think that's it's much better. Certainly when I played, the majority of time you had a non-Irish referee come in. It's a great break for them from terms of what they're used to in, whether in the Premiership or in the French or the Welsh League. You know, you don't used to do a lot of the big Leinster Munster games. And he or they would make as many mistakes as we probably saw at the weekend. But because they're not from Ireland, I think there's less scrutiny on it, you know. And it's very difficult, like for Chris Busby or Andrew Brace, it's incredibly difficult because there's so much happening. The game is incredibly hard to referee. The pressure's on, intense atmosphere on and off the field. and every error, every decision is scrutinized. And like, Busby, like the referees are being asked or to make quick decisions, refer less to TMO, right? But that pass to Nash, which he makes the call, it's a forward pass. And then when we see the replays, it's very marginal if it's forward. Probably my opinion would be it wasn't, but it's marginal. It's marginal. And then the debate is, why didn't he let it play out, try scored, and then come back? And that's the challenge. So they're getting pressurized from everywhere. They're getting pressurized from their own referee managers, and they're getting pressurized from TV and all this stuff, high ball and play time, less stoppages. But then the problem is, if you make a mistake, if you make a decision that's on the borderline, you're scrutinized, and I think that's harsh. Then obviously the Munster one is even more complicated, because obviously there was the mess up on the sideline where they weren't allowed to bring a player back on that they should have been allowed to bring back on, and that's horrendous. I mean, to try and play Leinster and Croke Park with all the internationals and be a man down for a reason that's not ill-discipline is a big error. Now, it's an error. It's a human error. But again, it doesn't help. It doesn't help the profile of the league. It doesn't help fans' trust in the officials, all the way down as far as fourth official. So yeah, it wasn't a great league. It wasn't a great weekend for that. I said I feel sorry for the referees. I don't think they were any worse than we would have got elsewhere. But I think from the whole perception point of view, at the moment it's difficult. Particularly, like, the reality is probably Leinster were going to win that game regardless. But fans will feel that to win it, they need a fair crack of the whip, and a bunch of fans certainly feel they didn't get it. There was a lot of decisions in the Ulster Connacht game which both sets of fans will feel were against them, and we're talking about officials rather than the game, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, and Johnny, like, just to emphasize the point, this wasn't exclusive to the Leinster Munster game. Like, I was watching the Ulster Connacht match back on Monday morning, because obviously didn't see it live on Saturday. But like, you had Ian Henderson went off with a concussion early in the first half for a tackle that I've no idea how that wasn't referred. They showed a replay of it, and play continued on. And then obviously you've Ulster scoring their late try where, we've all seen the picture now at this stage, where James McCormack is standing so far in field, how an assistant referee or referee isn't seeing that. It's like, we can probably pick out a couple more incidents as well. These are things off the top of the head. It's a good point Bernard made, obviously, that if there was a non-Irish referee in charge of these games, you might necessarily be getting more correct decisions, but we probably wouldn't be dwelling on the incorrect ones too much.
Yeah, I think the Irish referees get a bad time, but like, when Frank used to referee Munster and Connacht, like he played at both sides, and yet he'd be told he was for or against Connacht or Munster. Like, I thought it was just overly harsh. There's decisions that are made without caring who they're against, like, and I think they're right to do that. But yeah, like, I don't want to. I've chatted to Chris Busby around the game when he was an up and coming referee in the AIL, and he was very good with his time. And we've dealt with Andrew Brace quite a bit as well, and he's been very good. But so, like, it's not actually about the person here, and I want to emphasize that. But I do think watching Chris Busby, I think he's trying to be very authoritative, and I just think that the black and white decision making is actually hindering some of the decisions. Like, the forward pass one is case in point to that. Like, I think there's no good reason to be too authoritative there. Go to the TMO, take your time and have a look at it. Like, and I think there was probably a case for listening to Tadhg Byrne a small bit more at times. I'm not saying Tadhg Byrne, they were like getting Arsenal off at half time speaking to him. So he obviously was listening there in a break and play. Referees will say, come to me in a break and play, not when I'm trying to make a decision and there's a lot going on in their mind. And I get that. So coming off at half time is very different. I'm not trying to say that there was a favoritism there, but like, Tadhg Byrne as captain had concerns over the calls and probably wasn't listened to because Chris Busby was trying to put a marker down. And I just don't think that's altogether necessary. I think when the refs are working, particularly with a captain, when the refs are working with the captain, everything works out better. So I just don't think there was a need to be that strict on his own time. Bernard will say about ball and play time, he's right, but I don't think the game has to have the wrong call to get the ball and play time up. That's completely wrong.
Let's actually talk about the matches themselves then. because we've gone long enough without doing it. So Leinster 26, Munster 12, and Bernard, the whole way through that Munster-Leinster game at Croke Park, I could not stop thinking about the conversation yourself and Johnny Murphy had on the podcast last week, talking about Leinster's defence and how there are plenty of holes in it. There are ways to get around it or get over it or get through it. But it's not so much how you do that. It's the phase after the phase. And on countless occasions, Munster got, was it 27, 27 missed tackles from a Leinster point of view. There were plenty of times that Munster got into good positions. And to be honest, I wouldn't even say Munster were wasteful. I would give Leinster far more credit for how they just stopped Munster scoring in those situations rather than criticizing Munster for not doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Mike Prendergast, when he looked at it, would be so happy with a lot of the things that they obviously felt would work. It did work, obviously. They'll regress trying to play out the back, that early off an edge, which led to the first penalty, which led to Leinster kicking to the corner and scoring off it. I mean, that's what you can't give Leinster on attack. You can't give them soft opportunities like that where they catch behind the gain line. But in general, they did find lots of holes. But what they would be unbelievably frustrated with is that composure after line breaks. So Munster would say, we weren't composed. We made bad decisions. We went wide too early, etc. Whereas Leinster would be saying, wow, how good is our scramble? How good is our energy? How good is our discipline? You know, not to give back-to-back penalties or back-to-back line breaks. And Nina Barr will feel that the team is now starting to understand the system. He still won't be happy with all the line breaks, but they're not giving up soft scores. You know, the second try was kept a kick through Gavin Coombs, really well exploited. The backfield was open, but in general, Leinster's frontline organisation, I thought was pretty good. The physicality they brought was excellent, and to be honest, like a lot of this and. I think people might think this is harsh, but a lot of it's down to sheer athleticism. Like the Leinster props, okay, they struggle at scrum time, but they do move better and faster than the Munster props, you know, and that's only two bodies, you know what I mean? And you replicate that throughout the team. Like Caelan Doris, Gavin Coombs had a great game. Caelan Doris is a better athlete than Gavin Coombs. So when you have more better athletes, who are quicker, able to get up, get moving quick, moving better, they can scramble better. You know, it's not an attitude thing of Munster, and that's why I think I felt really sorry for Munster. But Munster, they were unbelievably brave. That game could have got out of hand on them pretty quickly at halftime. That could have been a 50-pointer, and they refused to let that happen. And you know, they fought for every ball after everything was a contest, and they made it as competitive as possible without really ever looking like winning, I didn't think. But yeah, that's what Leinster have, and that's what having that many internationals does, and it probably backs up Andy Farrell's selections. I mean, sometimes, okay, it's on social media, whatever, but I also just in person, Munster fans would give out to me about Andy Farrell being Leinster bias, and you know, Munster players are better than Leinster players, etc. And why aren't he getting picked for Ireland? But I thought, to be honest, I thought on Saturday, majority of those Irish internationals kind of showed that they are better at the moment than some of those Munster players, you know, and that's just probably backing up what Farrell says, and our Farrell decides by his selection. So it's unfortunate. I think Munster, to beat Leinster, need to have every single first choice player in their squad available. And then to have a bench, so whether that's Jaeger, Peter Manny, Abrahams, etc., Daly available, and that's not knocking the players who played in their place. And then they need to get ahead of Leinster. They need to get ahead of them, I think, because I think Munster, in fairness, probably went away a little bit from some of their attacking plan because they were chasing the game and maybe overplayed. And those periods there in the second half where they were playing five, six phases, getting knocked back, and if they were ahead or the score was a little bit closer, I think they would have been a little bit more pragmatic. And I think that's how you play Leinster. And the thing about Leinster is, the only fear about Leinster is obviously the last two games they haven't finished strongly, and I think that's mainly down to just the first two games for those first place players. But is there a screw in their head? Is there that doubt from not having won a trophy in a while? But the only way to test that is actually to be close to them or be ahead of them. And unfortunately for Munster, on this occasion they weren't close enough to test that, because I think physically Leinster are in a very strong place with the quality players they have.
Johnny, on the not scoring in the second half and following on from only scoring one try in the second half against Benetton, Leo Cullen was asked about it obviously as well, and Doris was as well. Like, what, how far along this line are you sitting of it's not really a huge amount to worry about, or it is a concern? Because depending on who you're speaking to, some people have been a little bit worried by how they've taken the foot off the pedal a little bit in the second half. Other people aren't really too worried, because the work rate is there in the defence, and you can still see the commitment that's there.
Yeah, but I think you said it there, the work rate's there in defence. I just wonder how much mental space the defence has taken from them, you know. And I'd be worried about not scoring in a half rugby, no matter who you are. Like, it doesn't really matter. I think you can't be that potent in attacking the first half and just not score in the second half. Something is going wrong there. And I know they're on the wrong side of the penalty count, so not to go back to the officiating, but I think because things went one way in the first half, the penalty count was what, 12-11 or 11-12 or whatever it was. And it was too close. Too close for a dominant game, I think, you know. So whether they would feel that they didn't get entries because it was just penalties against them, I actually think in the scrum, Birch came in here, but I think they were probably harshly treated in the scrum. But at the same time, I think they scrummage very aggressively when they just don't need to, you know. You can't go for every ball against the head, can you?
No, I think that's been the biggest issue, is that this isn't new, and when they are on the wrong side of few refereeing decisions, they don't adapt. They just keep going. And it's okay. It didn't cost them at the weekend, but it will cost them if they don't learn to stop. I mean, you're never going to change.
Sorry, Virgil, like you said, it will cost them. It has cost them.
Yeah, that's cost them. But I'm talking about this season. It's strange. It's really strange because they're a team who are very disciplined. You know, there's very rarely red cards, yellow cards. Usually, the penalty count is quite decent, quite low. And this is an area that I think they've just allowed, just particularly with that first choice prop, front row, or props, to just do what they want. And it's always, oh, well, we were dominant, we're being hard done by here. But unfortunately, like if you look at the stats, Leinster's penalty count at scrum time is incredibly high for a team who have the cattle they have. And I would be shocked if this isn't something that Leo Cullen is looking at, or Nina Barr is driving this, whether it's Robin or whoever, was saying we can't let that momentum does, like, and that's how Munster got that first try, was the first possession turnovers at a scrum, and that let them get into the game, a scrum where Leinster got penalised. So yeah, it's the only real blip. Their line out was good, their defensive line out was better. But that's the only real concern, you would say. And it's not from being dominated. They actually dominate the opposition, but they're given a very bad picture and image as the referee, and not adapting on the pitch as well, which is strange.
Yeah, I find it very strange because they're giving away, like you said, they're not being punished at the beginning, but their attacking platform has gone because of it. And that's where I'm going with it. Like, you know, they didn't score in the second half, probably for things within their own control, one or two things outside of their control. I actually think Munster, so yes, it would concern me that you're not scoring in a second half of rugby. 40 minutes of rugby you should score. Even Munster scored in two different 40 minutes of rugby and they lost the game, you know. So it's something that they should be doing. But I think from Munster's perspective, you can see how they previewed Leinster early on in the game. They tried to throw the ball over the top, that looping kind of what I call bridge pass. It can catch wingers static. It can sometimes be the right call, but I think Leinster is set up to cover that. They like the ball in the air and they like to recover. So I don't think that's going to catch them too much at the moment. Because if you're Jack Nienaber and you were doing that with South Africa for the last couple of years, you'll know the teams are throwing the ball over the top and he loves kind of scramble beyond that. So if you think about Gary Ringrose coming up high, Jamie Osborne's gone under, like, you know. So they will, and then you get close on the edge. They will get Calvin Ash on the edge, for example, and then Calvin kicked the ball in behind. Nanke will kick the ball in behind, but it didn't feel like they wanted to. Well, sorry, it felt like it was previewed. The opportunity was kind of there. I think Calvin's one was because he got that kind of bridge pass and had to put it on his toe. Nanke's one was because he probably thought there must be space because the front line is so heavy, but the full back was closing. I think there's a little in between kick that you can dribble in behind and cause trouble there. But it was actually when Tom Farrell decided to take on the midfield, I thought their game changed. And so there's a couple of different ways of beating a rush defence like that. And yes, you can go over the top and you have to kick the ball, you can go down the short side. But I think sometimes because they're coming up so hard, you have to go up the middle of it, you have to take it on. And if you don't take it on, you're never going to get rid of that hard press, you know. So it's interesting. I think if they went, hindsight is classic, like, but I think if they went through the guts of them from the start, they might have been a bit more confident, and they might not have let the match get away from them. Interesting, they birched the scrum. It was a turnover scrum in 4 minutes or whatever it was. It got them the penalty into the corner, and they
Mm.
scored that, wasn't it? Like the scrum going for it and being dominant on your feet, the ref is going to reward the attacking scrum. But trying to be that dominant against the feed, that's when they start penalising you. And I think they got that part wrong. But geez, there's so much good in the Leinster game, destroying the lineout and all the rest of it. It made Munster's life hard, like.
Certainly did, yeah. So that was Leinster 26, Munster 12. Leinster away to Connacht this Saturday evening, 7:35 p.m. kickoff. Munster also away down in South Africa on the first of their two-game tour away to the Stormers. Repeat of the 2023 final, 5 p.m. kickoff on Saturday evening. Ulster 32, Connacht 27. This was an absolute cracking derby. I watched it back on Monday morning, having only seen the highlights previously. So evenly matched, Bernard, I thought. And what just about probably tipped the scales was the overall edge that Ulster had to them on the night. We spoke about it last week that Stephen Ferris had, for example, kind of said that they had become a nice team to play against a little bit in the last couple of rounds. It certainly felt like they had an edge and a good kind of nastiness to them on Saturday.
No, very much so. I think Richie Murphy would be delighted. I think he, Pete Wilkins, in fairness, spoke about it last week, saying he expected a different Ulster. The team that was going to play against him was going to be vastly different than the team playing against the Bulls. So I think Richie had rested some bodies who were going to be key men in Ravenhill, that Ravenhill factor, that inter-pro factor. And yeah, there was a nice bit of an edge to Ulster. I think, yeah, obviously, we know even their Dan McFarland, their line-out maul was a weapon, that's still there. And it was surprising, actually. It was a night where that was the, you know, that the maul and the pick and go game was the, you know, a primary source of scores for both teams, you know. Connacht and Ferris would be delighted. That was a big issue for them last year. Their conversion rate from kicking to the corner and turning down points was I think it was the second lowest in the league, or certainly in the bottom four. And already this season, you know, they've used that maul to telling effect in numerous games. So they have got confidence there, and that's important for them. We know they want to be an attacking team. They only want to fire shots. A ball in hand, I mean, from attack. We know they've got an X factor in their back three. But unfortunately, as the weather gets worse, you know, you sometimes have to just get a job done up front, and they're looking much better drilled there. So John Maloon will be very happy. Obviously Cooney gets a great try, Ben Murphy gets a great try. But apart from that, I thought defences were pretty much on top. And Connacht scratching their head again. It's another game they could have won, like the game against Munster, but didn't, but get 2 points out of it and have had a decent start points wise, and Ulster needed that win and got it.
Yeah, and Johnny, like what Bert said there, Connacht's probably getting better at converting when they get down into the corner. But the frustration is now in the two defeats they've had this season to Ulster and away to Munster. They have had an opportunity to get down into the corner late on in the game and either score an equalising try or a winning try, and they haven't been able to take it. Like the Josh Ioane missing touch against Munster late on in that game at Thomond Park. Another penalty late enough in the evening on Saturday evening went too deep and missed touch again. Now, he did make up for it by getting a penalty on the board to get them back into the bonus point territory, but there's another world there where Connacht have 4 wins out of 4. Now, you could probably also look at the other two games and say there's another world where Connacht have 4 defeats out of 4. So you can pick and choose your arguments, obviously.
Yeah, I just think an out half missing touch at AIL level, we say one is too many. Like, you know, you just don't miss touch. It's not good enough, you know, and that's quite frustrating. I know everyone makes mistakes when you're an out half. Like, I don't, obviously, I played there. So, like, you're in the limelight. It's the same as a hooker throwing in. You don't want to really get after anyone with the position specific skills, but just get it to touch. Like, you can't go for too much, or your skill set has to make sure that you get there. And I know you have to kick for corners. Like, otherwise, you know, if you kick to 20 meters out, the pack have so much work to do. So you are trying to get into the corner, but it's so destroying when you miss The thing I think about both teams is like yeah, they were good in the maul, but they were very poor in the defensive maul. Like when you come up against a side that that can score from mauls, and yeah, you might get one, but if they can stop you, which will happen in the depths of the winter, like especially we see Connacht now against Leinster this weekend. If you see what if they get stopped, you can't just kind of score one and concede one and score another one. Like it just doesn't work, So when I was probably overly critical of Connacht at the start of the season, wondering will their squad get them there. They've obviously started the season really well, and they're playing a lot of good rugby. But it's when things get tougher, or you lose a body or two, and you can't just drive one over because the opposition are as good as you, or they have a good defensive maul, then that becomes an issue. So that's probably one of the things I took away from the game. They were kind of like, "Oh, you score, I score." John Cooney, Ben Murphy, as you said, Birch. It's kind of when they come up against the depths of it and better opposition, I wonder where that would go.
The Ben Murphy try, I think we're mentioning him every week, but it's more so I think just down to the fact that he caught so many people by surprise this season. But like that try on Saturday night was a great example where there had been a line out 2 or 3 minutes previous in a similar position, and you can kind of see him trying to maneuver a situation where he can get the ball and they can go down into that corner, because obviously Werner Kock has been sin-binned, and you can almost see it in his face. He knows there's a gap there to attack. And I would say as soon as that ball is popped down off the top, he has his sights set firmly on just going straight down for that corner, where there's so much space to attack.
What I like about
Yeah.
Ben Murphy is, sorry, Birch. What I like
No,
about Ben
go.
Murphy is the delivery, 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 and that's what he gets away. Like it's I've seen him with Clontarf last year, and obviously he's played with Leinster and stuff. But like, I think what separates a player at that level is that they just deliver the ball to and do their main job, deliver the ball to the other half or whoever needs it, and be rapid on that. And we see that from Gibson Park and Craig Casey, I think, as well. To be fair, Murray's done it for years. Like, his delivery is a basic part of their game. It's when you keep delivering, you get gaps. And he's been rapid upfield as well, hasn't he? Like, his support line, his intent to get on off the shoulder, something that's keeping Kieran Blade out of the team at the moment, which is his game as well. So it's what a competition they have.
You were coming in there,
Yeah,
Brian.
no, I just think it's a lovely story. I mean, Johnny mentioned seeing him play for Clontarf, but he's definitely a player that a lot of people weren't sure if he had it, to be fair. Like, he had certain attributes, but like he jumped around a few AIL clubs, and he wasn't always first choice for Clontarf. Now, this isn't anyone's fault. Like, it's sometimes hard when you're in an academy system and you're getting released on a Thursday, and there's a fella playing there, who's there every week and every night to get in. But like, he is someone who's absolutely dedicated to his craft. Like, when I was doing a bit in Prez Brae, he was coaching the under 13s, he was coaching the under 14s, under 15s. He'd be down an hour and a half beforehand with a bag of balls, just doing box kicks on his own, because Jack would be in class, his brother. And like, doing box kicks on your own and going fetching the ball and stuff. It's not glamorous, you know what I mean? He didn't have a car, he was getting the bus from Donnybrook, out back to Bray. He's just spent the last 3 or 4 years, well, probably all his career, whatever, but since he started playing rugby, just working on it. He's quite a shy guy, but now he just seems to have found confidence. And I'd say it's from the confidence his coaches, Sexton and Wilkins, have put in him, how they identified him as someone who could add to their team, even though he wouldn't have been a big glamour signing. He took his chance in preseason, and he's had an amazing start. And it's great to see someone like that just get that chance and take it. And he fully deserves it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think for the general, like, kind of rugby audience as well, everyone loves to see a player kind of come out of nowhere with a team. That's, a player that you weren't really expecting to be shining to all of a sudden shine is always just it's just a fun thing for the spectator to enjoy. We are running out of time. Last point I do want to bring up, though, obviously, as well, is to bring it back around to Ulster. So 4 games in, 2 wins, 2 defeats. They've had to juggle a decent enough injury list. They've had to deal with players away on Emerging Ireland duty who are thankfully back now for this weekend. As good a win as it was on Saturday night, Johnny, this feels like a game now against the Ospreys on Friday night at home, where you have to back up what you did at the weekend.
I think, yeah, that's exactly it. You have to back it up. You know, like, teams win. You know what I mean? Everyone can get a win, but it's backing it up. But having the chance to do it at home 2 weeks in a row, there'll be a comfort level there, where they'll be confident, you know? So they do, unfortunately, while they're getting players back, they're getting a bit of an injury list as well, aren't they? So, like, things aren't getting any easier for Richie Murphy. But, you know, I think is Cormac Izichukwu back for this weekend? I think, like, him and Dave McCann, we've spoken with them on the podcast a few times. Dave McCann has, you know, tackle stats off the charts, and, you know, getting fellas like that into your pack. I've kind of said, like, conceding maul tries and stuff like that. And Birch said it there earlier about Leinster, like, when you have, it doesn't really matter when you've got your best players available to you. Coaching becomes easier all of a sudden. You wonder why, but, like, you're just dealing with players that get it. And it's funny, I spoke to a coach the other day, and he was saying, geez, coaching gets tougher when you miss a couple of lads. That's when coaching starts. You know, you have to go, you coach everyone, and that's what you're there for. But all of a sudden, you see conversion rates when a fella just gets it, or it's not even that. Like, they might all get it, but it's just a bit of, you know, just have a moment. I think it's moments for better players. Cormac Tuchupu will have moments. Dave McCann will have moments. And I think that's where, you know, they could do it having a full squad. But yeah, you're right, backing it up. John Cooney back on the attack. A lovely spiral bomb, actually, as well. That's something I'm into. But having fellas like that picking off moments on the short side of a ruck will make a big difference trying to back it up against the Ospreys.
Yeah, so that game is Friday night, Ulster against the Ospreys at Kingspan Stadium, 7:35 kickoff. Stormers hosting Munster, 5 p.m. kickoff. That's the live game on RT2 and RT Player on Saturday evening. And then that's followed 7:35, Connacht against Leinster at the Dexcom Stadium, a second Interpro in a row for Connacht and Leinster as well. Bernard and Johnny, it's been great having you on as always. Stay tuned for those who want to listen to some WXV coverage. I spoke to Hannah O'Connor a little bit earlier on. Here's what we had to say. Now, I'm delighted to welcome back onto the podcast Hannah O'Connor. Once again, the WXV is over, and it's safe to say it was a very, very successful tournament for Ireland. They capped it off with their second win out of three and their third win in four games in this auto block. 26-14 bonus point winners against the USA, thanks to, I suppose, a fairly clinical last 15 minutes after knocking and knocking and knocking on the door. Before we get into the match itself, Hannah, probably just do need to take a moment and reflect on an incredibly successful 2024 and specifically second half of 2024.
Yeah, it's been brilliant. It's definitely in terms of kind of laying out the year ahead, the targets that the girls would have set, I'd say it's definitely surpassed them and where they've come from. When you think of last year being in Dubai for WX3 against the caliber of opposition that was there, you know, winning that and doing a job, but having question marks, I suppose, over their worthiness then to be in WXV1 when it came around after a good Six Nations, they said had to back it up. And back it up they did. It was, an incredible run of this block of 6 weeks that they were involved in to come away with the three wins out of four against that type of opposition is where they want to be. And it's a really, really good place to be ahead of the year that's ahead with the World Cup.
Yeah, it certainly is. And that draw coming up on Thursday, tomorrow as well. So we might touch on that before we finish up. But it was interesting before the game, Scott Beamon and Enya Breen were doing their press conference on, I think it was the last Wednesday night or last Thursday evening. And one thing Enya said that really stood out, I think, was that we were asking her about the fact that now that Ireland are starting to put together some results and performances as well in the game against Canada, they lost, that there's all of a sudden now teams probably are going to be looking at them a little bit different, and the public too are going to be looking at them a little bit different. And I think this was the first time now, this USA game, where there actually was, well, not that more, that it was a surprise, but that there was expectation on them to deliver rather than to just kind of put up a good show. There was a bit of an expectation on them to deliver there. And look, it took them a while to get through it, but they did it, and I think did it in quite bullish fashion in that last quarter as well.
Yeah, look, the expectation, I suppose, was there, I suppose, with the public looking in, but it's an expectation that's always there when you wear the green jersey. You never want to be in the position that we were a couple of years ago where you're getting the wooden spoon in a Six Nations. Like, that's not the standards that, you know, we want for ourselves when you're representing the country, and it's definitely not one that you want to be sticking with, you, or you don't want the sympathy of like, oh, shouldn't they be doing well, and da da da. So yeah, and you'd probably talked about, you know, the girls would have had their sights set on this game and finishing this block off high. You know, it was a sense of resetting from the Canada game and being able to, as you said, like finish the block off on a high more than anything. It's kind of that inward thing. They wouldn't really have been looking at the outside pressure too much. It would have been more on the job that they were doing and that they knew they could do, putting in a performance. Now, while it wasn't a vintage performance along up the standards of the New Zealand game, you know, those games sometimes are as satisfying to win because it's a bit of a mess and a bit of a dogfight for the game that it is. And you know, you get the decisions then, a few decisions to go your way in terms of, you know, a try that was a fingertips away for not being given, but it's good, like so. And the yellow cards obviously helped massively, as you said, the last 15 minutes they turned the screw, but they have to be in the game to be able to turn the screw in the first place. And they did that with the first half. You know, that game starts off and it's quite a clinical, you know, 15 minutes from Ireland. If you look at it, they've got great entries into to the scoring zone, and then they just can't quite convert them. You know, USA brought massive physicality in the defensive front. The girls probably were a little bit off that at the start from their own standards, but they had the entries, they were doing all the right things, getting themselves in there. And it was like little tiny things like last passes or just not being able to get across the line. They were getting penalties after penalties. USA were giving them every in into that area. And then it was either like just a couple of things to give USA back an easy out, or to let the foot off the pedal, allow it to be 7-0 to USA. They had two breaks. Three breaks, probably one which was kind of salvaged by a great cover tackle from Aaron King, but the breaks then that resulted in just them kind of capitalizing. And it's a real sucker punch because you spend like what, 15 minutes or so camped down trying to eke out a score of your own. You come away with nothing, and all of a sudden, bang, bang, and two breaks, and USA used the forward power. And Hope Rogers was having an inspired performance, the USA prop on her 50th. So she got the job done twice. So all of a sudden it's 7-0, a great kind of opportunistic try for Ireland's comeback, one of a penalty advantage that brings you all the way back to the five. And Aaron King said, thank you very much. And 7-7. So yeah, those kind of little, you know, bits to keep them in the game, still going in trailing at 14-7 at halftime, would have been a frustrating first half for Ireland because of the opportunities they had and to still be on the wrong side of the scoreboard, despite the few kind of forays USA had into Ireland's half. They were more clinical and being able to convert. So yeah, definitely a kind of a, I'd say, stern words at half time to kind of shake it off and go again, which they did.
Yeah, it was funny, like the first half in particular, pretty much right at the halftime whistle when USA scored and it's 14-7. What was just going through my head for most of it was this is Italy again. That Italy game from earlier on in this year's Six Nations where
Yeah.
absolutely dominated for the first 20 minutes and just couldn't pull the trigger, and then obviously they got the scores. But I'm gonna fast forward right up to the final, I think it was a
10 or 12, really, wasn't it?
15
Probably
minutes or so,
more,
because it's 14 points apiece. It's 14 points apiece. Ireland have finally got themselves back level courtesy of the penalty try, which kind of came about some great work from Molly Scuffle McCabe, but obviously
yeah.
worked their way down. USA have started picking up a couple of cards now. At this moment in time, they're down to 13 players, and Ireland get a penalty just to the right of the post, 5 meters out. It is like a tap over for Dana O'Brien.
I know.
What are you thinking when they turn to the corner? Are you shouting points at your
Yeah,
screen, or
I
are you, what do you
was.
think?
Yeah, I was actually, because I was like, I was thinking about it, because you could see the discussion happening, and I'm like, just take the three. And I was like, it wasn't even that you don't back the set piece, but it was just the set piece was breaking their hearts a little bit. But when they got it right, it was perfect. It was like you said, like it was like teams kind of the lineout we had kind of I'd lauded in the first game against the Black Ferns, like as being a real weapon, like, and there's those tweaks. So it's, as you said, like teams are going to kind of sit up a little bit more and take a bit of notice when you go out and beat the world champion. So the kind of that's kind that kind of happened in the Canada and the USA game. Now it's fine margins, it's tiny things like that you could nitpick over, but like it's an area that going into next year the girls will want to keep building on, because it has improved massively since even Six Nations time with the new coaching system and they brought in and stuff like that. But yeah, I was at that stage shouting points because I was like, oh, we've overthrown a few and there's been fingertips and we've missed kind of the connections on timings and stuff like that. And I was like, just take the three, take the next kickoff, and still you're still a woman up and you'll still have received kickoff and you'll be able to build again and punish them again, the way the USA were kind of faltering at that stage. But I was like, it's one of those things you've seen in the men's game before where the call is made to go to the touchline and you back the set piece. And you know, as you've seen, like when it works, it's brilliant. Like as you said, Molly Scuffle-McCabe made a brilliant chinking break off the maul that did work down the blind side, and Eimear Constantine and herself went on a darting run, which led to that most bizarrest of penalty tries when I think the Irish girls were as surprised nearly as the USA girl that was happening at the time. But yeah, fair play. It was a ballsy move to do. And it's one of those ones that pays off and you look back on it and say, you know, class, well done, it paid off. So it was great.
Yeah, it was, and like obviously hindsight is brilliant, but this gorgeous
Yeah.
guy, and as you said, Lena by a fingertip
Fingertip.
manages to hold on to that ball. But look, they all count, and
Yeah.
from that moment, there was only actually one winner when you look back at it.
Yeah.
There might have been nerves at the time watching it, but I watched it back there yesterday morning, and once Ireland scored that try to go ahead, the USA had just ultimately gave up, to be honest. There's so much to take from this year and this campaign as well. I think one big thing leading up to the World Cup next year that was mentioned quite a bit leading up to this is building squad depth and building just additional players in those extra positions. And you look over these last few games and you see there's a lot of stuff coming out of it now where you have like Niamh O'Dowd started all three games and did a very, very fine job. They've had to play this campaign without Sam Monahan, obviously, as well. Fiona Chute has started every game and has done very, very well. In the centres now, you can pick any two of Aoife Dalton, Enya Breen, and Eve Higgins, and you know exactly what you're going to get. The back three has been mixed around quite a bit this year just because of injuries, like Katie Carrigan starting every game in the Six Nations, doing really, really well. Eimear Considine coming back in here as well. And other players have been involved as well. So there are so many options to choose from there. And also now as well in the back row where you've got Aaron King to throw into the mix. I mean, Adele McMahon must have been watching those last two games going, God, am I going to be getting my place back come Six Nations?
I know, yeah, as I said, the depth is what you need, like especially heading into a World Cup year, and it's depth, as you said, like you need people to have experienced the big games or to have gotten minutes under their belt to be able to not just be thrust in kind of off the bench and feeling the nerves when it comes to the big competitions. Because realistically you do have big competitions before, you know, you have Six Nations, which is a big one, and then you obviously are straight into the World Cup, probably with a few warm-up matches along the way. But you needed people to get up to scratch with that minutes. And yeah, I said there's competition everywhere. And there's a bit of depth there in key places that we've kind of missed over the last while. So yeah, as I said, Sam will come back into that fold, and as will Adele McMahon. They'll be hunting for their spots back as well. I said nothing is a given. So look, it's a healthy place to be. It adds to very competitive training sessions that have been there since Scott has come in. So they're in a good place. I said it's very easy to or easier to come back into the next block, pre Six Nations, they'll probably come back in. It's easier to come into that with the momentum that's there, the bite that'll be there from everybody to try and nail their places down a little bit more. Yeah.
On Scott then, what were your first impressions of him when he did come in? Like he obviously came in last summer. When would have been your first encounter with him over that period? I can't remember now. Were you involved WXV last year?
No, it wasn't. That was
Yeah,
it
that was
was
then
a
as well.
great first experience. Yeah, no, I suppose my one, yeah, it was coming in Six Nations, I suppose. So it was a little bit different to most because I was coming in as a hadn't been in for WXV, didn't get the selection on that one, and then it'd come in pre Six Nations as like a training panelist. So that was a bit kind of a strange one to take initially, but as I had a chat with him, and I just wanted to make sure that I was still in the ring for selection, and that's all I cared about really. Once I was, and I managed
And
to,
then you were come France, wasn't it?
yeah, I know. So that's all I cared about was that. So it was a bit of a strange one, but no, I suppose what he brings is like, you know, he's been there, done that. So like the level of experience and nous that he has is top tier. Like, you know that he knows what he's on about, and you know that he's, you know, the experience when he's talking about certain oppositions or the prep he's doing leading into games and the tactic he's putting in place. He's done that before with the Red Roses. So like there's great kind of comfort in that, knowing that you can kind of buy into it. Yeah, he's a He's kind of very straight talking coach. There's kind of no beating around the bush. Like, he'll tell you straight up what exactly it is, what it is, and that's what's needed really, in the women's game, in any game. But like, you know, as female teams, or anybody who's been involved in coaching female teams, there'll always be a lot of questions from a women's team, like a lot of like, why,
That's
what are
been,
you?
yeah, that is a, I remember that came up at a press conference that I think it was Declan Danaher,
Oh yeah.
during the Six Nations this year was asked, it was his first time obviously coaching a women's team, and he was
Yeah.
asked, has anything stood out as being a little bit different? And I can clearly remember him saying that the women's players will ask so many more questions when you tell them to do something.
Yeah.
The men's teams can just, I suppose, be very programmed into yes sir, no sir. But
Yeah.
you're saying
I
like, well,
think,
you know, why are we doing this? Why does this make sense? What's the
yeah,
this? What's
women, the women like to know exactly, like the kind of, it's like, yes, we're doing this. But why are we doing this if we could, like, it's not even an arguing against it. It's more like all the possible realms of why we could possibly be doing this, and da, 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 this leads to this, and what if that leads to that, and if that does that, then if we do this, it's a complete yes. Yeah. So you can imagine, like, when you're standing there and if you're moving forwards and a back split, the questions, it's like, Jesus, yeah, you could be there for a while with all the questions. But no, he's very much, I think the difference has been made. I think that I noticed most, obviously, his know-how and him being there. But I think the coaching ticket is, like, we've been crying out for it over the last few years in terms of, like, experienced coaches in the right areas to help players develop in the key spots. So to have, like, a defensive coach and a forwards coach and a kicking coach now in there, it's like those boxes that have been ticked, that have been crying out to be ticked for the last number of years. It's piecing all those bits together, like the jigsaw, like we said. It's like, the girls are there and they'll give you everything, and they'll give you 110% of their effort and their time. They just need to be kind of steered along the right way. The investments that have been made there are going in the right direction. And I think the likes of David Humphreys there coming in has done a great job in terms of, even on the ground, in terms of getting to know us and things like that, and been away with us during the Six Nations. I think he's shown a real interest in that, and I think that's, you know, stands in good stead for going forward into a really busy year for the women's team.
Well, speaking of going forward into a very busy year, we World Cup draw tomorrow, but also
Yeah.
Six Nations next year. That was one of the things Scott and Enya were asked after the game on Friday night. And you know, the next step now is the next step of what is the target for a Six Nations? Is it win three away games and try and knock off of France at home, or is that gap of still a little bit too wide? What are your thoughts on what the Six Nations goals should be? Is it a case of consolidate a comfortable third place with three good away wins?
I think you can't really settle for it. I think you have to aim high. So I think the same way they would have aimed high going into this competition, you know, they got their, I think I predicted a bonus point win in the end. Just gonna throw that out there. But I think they have to aim high. So they'll be looking at top two. They'll think, why not? Like, because, you know, if you get that momentum from your away games, and I think it's France at home first, isn't it? So like, it's like first game we saw it this year playing against them, you can have a crack at it and have a rattle at it. You have a good lead up into it. It's that unknown of any series when you go into it first game. You never really know what you're going to get, which can be a good thing and a bad thing. So, like, bringing France to Ireland and playing them on our shores, as the girls will talk about, that'll be the next thing on their calendar. That'll be the next thing up on a whiteboard. That's the date. That's the one to go at. And I don't think, why not? Like, if they can play like they did against the Black Ferns and get it all clicking in place, and they have a really good run in now and a really good block. And as we talked about, you've got the momentum of winning three games out of a four and a block, and like of the caliber that they played against, why not? Like, so they definitely will set their sights high. They'll take it each game as it comes, but they'll have those targets. And I think, yeah, why not? They've gotten for third place last year, probably against, or like this year just gone against what most people might have fancied them for. So I think, why not? I think, why not aim high and see what happens with it.
And then the last port of call, obviously, is everything that's going to be done between now and the end of next summer is viewed in that prism of the World Cup and what this means for the
Yeah.
World Cup. And first of all, we've got the draw coming up on Thursday, Ireland in band two, which, you know, at the start of the season, they wouldn't have been in. They would have been back
Yeah.
there in number three, like Wales sitting, unfortunately for them, in band three at the moment. So you've got England, Canada, New Zealand, and France in pot number one. So Ireland will have one of those as an
Yeah.
opponent. Australia, Ireland, Scotland, and Italy are in band two. USA, Wales, Japan, South Africa, Spain, Samoa, Fiji, Brazil is the final band. What's the worst case scenario in that? Who are the teams you want to avoid? I mean, I presume in band one, you don't want to get England, but I mean, I think any of the other three is it's not the worst thing in the world.
No, I think England probably are the ones you want to avoid where possible if you can till hopefully knockout stages. But yeah, it's a good place to be in, isn't it? It's a healthier place to kind of bump ourselves up a little bit to get into that band. But it's kind of much of a muchness then between some. But yeah, band one, yeah, we'll take a crack at, like I said, after beating who we've beaten, you take a crack at anyone. Obviously, New Zealand will be coming back with a vengeance. That would make for a spicy pool draw if we ended up popped in with them for that one. But I think they won't look too far ahead or be kind of worrying about anything really. It's kind of they're there now, and that was the main thing to kind of solidify that and not have that lingering over their heads. And whatever happens after that, they'll be definitely in the mindset of going for everything when it comes to it.
Yeah, and it just does sum up to kind of finish off this chat. It kind of sums up the year that here we are talking about what would be a good or bad draw for Ireland. 10 months ago, we probably would have been talking about let's just get there and see where we are. And the realistic thought at the time would have been that if Ireland are getting there, you're probably in band three. It was very much just about getting there. But here they are now, second in the WXV, and I think jumped up to fifth overall in the world rankings, up from 10th at the start of the
Yeah,
season.
six or six, isn't it? And like that's the thing, like it's completely different light that you get to look at it with. It's not looking at it with that kind of morose or that kind of doldrums look that's been looked upon the women's team over the last few years. It's looking at it now with excitement and with energy for it, with the big competition year ahead, and it's lovely to be in that space of to be talking, as you said, with such a kind of critiquing eye, to be able to like pinpoint certain things, but to be able to be winning matches and still not be overly happy with their performances probably in that USA game. But it certainly makes it a lot easier to build and to kind of layer onto that and kind of grow the momentum. When you're winning, when you're eking out wins, and as I said, you're beating three of those teams out of the four in that block that they've played. So it's certainly a different kettle of fish altogether to be looking at it, and puts us in a good place and an exciting place for the year ahead.
Yeah, it certainly does. So plenty to work on, but plenty to be excited about heading into what's going to be a really, really interesting 2025. Hannah, it's been great having you on the podcast with us over the last few weeks, and I'm sure we'll check in with you a little bit further down the line, closer towards the Six Nations into the new year. It's been great having you, Hannah. All the best. Thank you very much.
Cheers. Thanks a million, Neil.